OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine moves to a new and bloodier phase as Putin unleashes a campaign to crush the Ukrainian military in the Donbass region in the east. What's at stake for NATO and the United States? Plus, French voters go to the polls this weekend as right-wing populist Marine Le Pen challenges incumbent President Emmanuel Macron. We'll have a report directly from Paris. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, and here with me are Kim Strassel, not in Paris, in the U.S. of A., but Adam O'Neill as well, who is our man, our lucky man in Paris at the moment. Before we get to the French elections, let's talk about Ukraine and the new Russian offensive there. They're moving some 60 battle tank groups into the east, reinforcing what they already have there to try to surround the Ukrainian forces. And they're closing in as well on the capture of the incredibly brave Ukrainian forces in Mariupol, the coastal city that's been under siege for 6 weeks now. The U.S. is rushing more arms to Ukraine, including $800 million worth in a new batch that includes heavy weapons, such as howitzers and medium-range artillery. And U.S. officials are saying privately that they think this war could be settled in the next 2 to 4 weeks, or at least the Battle of Donbass could be settled in the next 2 to 4 weeks. If Russia surrounds and kills the Ukrainian military in the east, it may force Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, to negotiate on Putin's terms. But if Ukraine can hold out and reach a stalemate in the east, pressure will rise on Putin as Russian casualties rise. So, Kim, let's talk about this. I guess I'm really heartened that the Biden administration is finally providing more heavy weapons, but boy, is it late in the game here. The war has been going on for 6 weeks. The Battle of Kiev has been over. I wonder just how much difference it would make if we'd provided those heavy weapons earlier.
Well, according to Volodymyr Zelensky, had we done that, the war might be over now. That is what he has been telling Western media outlets, saying, quote, if we had access to all the weapons we need, which our partners have, and which are comparable to the weapons used by the Russian Federation, we would have already ended this war. And that is what Zelensky said in a video address Tuesday evening. We can't look back and say that for certain, but there can be no question that we have been way too slow on this. It took us weeks to get those S-300 air defense systems to them. We are still even now, as far as I understand, while we have pledged howitzers, we have not even yet begun the training that Ukrainians need to be able to operate those systems. Those MiG-29s are still sitting somewhere. It took weeks and weeks for us to get them drones. And the other problem, too, is even this latest package of equipment that the Biden administration settled and announced last week, $800 million worth of different pieces, noted there was a report in NBC News on Saturday noting that given the speed with which the Ukrainian military is going through, for instance, artillery rounds, the 40,000 that we are sending them would only last a little over 1 week, which is why the administration is again now thinking about how to ship yet more. But speed is now becoming of the essence, and Zelensky is hitting on this again and again, because every day that goes by is another day Russia digs in, and that makes it harder to get to that end game of trying to finish this some way.
Adam, give us your take. You've been following the war since the beginning, from your post in Warsaw, and then you popped up to Lithuania and around to NATO headquarters in Brussels. What do you think the prospects are immediately in this Battle of Donbass? And I ask that because a senior Pentagon official I know has said that he thinks it could go either way, that actually Ukraine could still win this if it has the right weapons. This is one of the reasons the Pentagon officials really want to send as much as they can to the Ukrainians. The reluctance, such as it is, has been from the White House not wanting to cross certain lines. They fear Putin might have to use nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, or escalate. And then what are the stakes here for the United States?
Right. Well, it's hard to say whether they can win, because we have to define what win means, right? If it's drive the Russians out of the Donbass and out of the Donbass region, the two regions that make up the Donbass, and to drive them out of Crimea, to drive them out of Ukraine pre-2014, I'm skeptical that that could happen, at least not without more heavy weapons support. But if the Ukrainian army can survive the coming offensive, or the offensive that has begun, push back the Russians in some places, do tremendous amount of damage, that could actually be considered a win, given where we were 8 weeks ago when this war began. And I think that's entirely possible. And for weeks, as the Battle of Kyiv was winding down and the Russians were moving their equipment and soldiers away from the center of the country and moving them and focusing their energy on the south and east to prepare for this, that's what I've been hearing from my sources and from analysts who follow this closely, similar to what you're hearing, is that it's a bit of a toss-up in terms of how this goes in just a one-to-one battle, the way that you would judge a one-on-one battle, right? Not necessarily the political objectives that define whether you win or lose a war. As for what this means for the United States, I think it's meant what it's always meant throughout the war, is that if a dictator somewhere in the world, and there are plenty of them, not just in Russia, not just in Europe, in the east of Europe, but also throughout Asia and in parts of Africa, or even maybe some areas in Latin America, dictators, if they see, wow, if I have superior military force, if I completely blatantly ignore international law, yeah, maybe I'll get some economic sanctions, but who cares? I'm rich. All of my generals are paid because we're looting the country. They'll take that lesson and say, well, let's go do this. But now you have Russia. Before the war, some people would say that they were second only to the United States in terms of conventional military power. And I think that we've figured out that it's not that easy for militaries to achieve these kinds of objectives, especially when the population, frankly, hates them, does not want them to be there, wants them to die just for entering their country so violently. And if the Ukrainians can win the Battle of the Donbass, and however you define it, but if it can be a win, considered for them a win and a loss for the Russians, no matter how they spin it, I think that sends a really important message and will make the world a lot safer, not just in Europe, but everywhere.
The battle for the Donbass is crucial for those reasons, in my view, Kim, but also if Putin wins this battle in the east, and let's say he consolidates total control over the Donbass, and then that would give him the ability to reinforce troops in the east and then go make a play for Odessa further south. They've been stymied so far trying to take Odessa. If they do that, then they have cut Ukraine entirely off from the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. So it will have no outlet to the sea for its exports and economic lifeline. And obviously, that's tremendously damaging to the long-term prospects for the Ukrainian economy, also for its general livelihood as a country. And it also puts Putin in the position where he could sue for some kind of negotiated truce or settlement in the near term, but always be able to attack Kyiv or the rest of Ukraine in the future after he has built up reinforcements and learned the lesson of this war. And of course, all the while trying to kill Zelensky, because that has to be one of his main military goals at this stage, because Zelensky has been such a great rallying point for the Ukrainian people to make these extraordinary sacrifices that they're making, such as Mariupol. I mean, it truly is an extraordinary story how they are holding out despite ultimatums from the Russians and despite what the mayor there has said are 20,000 casualties. We can't confirm that independently, but it certainly seems plausible given all of the unrelenting bombing that has taken place there. So this is crucial. And then, of course, if Russia has Ukraine, as Zbigniew Brzezinski used to say, the former Carter National Security Advisor, it can be an empire. Without Ukraine, it is a much weaker nation.
Right. I think everything you needed to know about Putin's ambitions were laid out in the opening stages of this war. It was his attempt to take the entire country. You could see that by the way in which they arrayed their forces and moved on every place from Kyiv to Chernihiv and Sumy, other places. They wanted the entirety of the country. And just because he has now been forced to retreat to the area that he is now contesting, it doesn't mean that he's given up on those ambitions whatsoever. And in fact, I think you're entirely right, Paul, that this current strategy is aimed at solidifying that land bridge, as it were, from the Crimea up through the country, then being able to better stage for Odessa. And then ultimately, maybe it might even be years from now to have recouped enough forces to accomplish the goal of total control of Ukraine. And remember what that does too, to your point on empire, is it puts the Russian Empire right up against Poland, right up against Romania, right up against EU countries. It threatens the Baltics. It's really, it would be a seismic shift in Russia's balance of power and the situation in Europe. So this is why, again, all the more important that the United States needs to be, and Europe needs to be, continuing to think aggressively and as quickly as possible about the ways in which that you assist this incredible country, which is, to your point, is it's remarkable what the Ukrainian people have accomplished so far.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a little more on Ukraine and some of the consequences for Russian athletes and so on, and the G20 plus the French elections. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here with my colleagues Adam O'Neill and Kim Strassel. Let's talk a little bit more about Ukraine. A couple of points that are interesting in the news. The Wimbledon tennis tournament is banning Russian participants this year, which is causing some consternation within the Russian government, says it's totally unacceptable. I know there's a difference of opinion about that among some people thinking, why punish individual Russians here? But I actually support this as a symbolic gesture of just the unhappiness, just the outrage over the brutality of the Russian invasion, the humanitarian catastrophe that it represents. The two of you might disagree with me about that. And just one other symbolic point. The G20 meeting of the G20 nations, Russia is normally a participant, taking place in Washington here shortly, and Russia will be a participant. Now, I think that is a real outrage. They should have pushed Russia out of that. I know some of the countries will confront Russia at that meeting, but you really need to isolate a Russia that behaves like this in the international system. What do you think about that, Adam?
It's a case-by-case issue for me when it comes to how you isolate Russia. Kicking them out of the G20 to me seems like a no-brainer. They were kicked out of the G8 after 2014. It's harder to build up that consensus because you go beyond just countries like Japan, the United States, right, and the major European powers. And I believe Indonesia is currently, I think they call it the presidency of the G20 or something. And they oppose that, right, because these are historically non-aligned countries who rely on Russia for one thing or another economically. When it comes to something like Wimbledon, again, it's a judgment call, and I would support banning Russian athletes from competitions. There are some things that I think are kind of dumb, like when a university says, we're not going to teach Dostoevsky anymore. Yeah, right. I mean, if anything, while I've been in Paris, someone who also knows a lot about Russia, we kind of got off track when we were talking about the election. She said, if you want to understand Russia, you have to read Dostoevsky, right? Even if you hate Russia, right? you need to read these people. And you've seen other pretty dumb things like renaming some institute after a famous Russian dissident who was the kind of person you would want to support, you know, the name being changed because he's Russian. So it shouldn't just be because people are Russian, but in reality, we don't know exactly how many Russians support Putin. If a pollster, even from a reputable place like the Levada Center, calls you and you're out in the boonies in the Far East or something and says, what do you think of Putin? You really think that person's going to speak honestly if they don't like Putin as he's imprisoning all of his enemies and whatnot? But there is a legitimate, true base of support, a rally around the flag effect, even for an evil and unjust war. And that's just from their perspective. I was friends with I had dinner once with a Ukrainian who fought in the Red Army, who's a little older during the Soviet Union. And he says he gets in arguments to this day on Facebook with his old Red Army unit. about whether Ukraine is a real country. They had once fought for the same military. These are difficult questions, and they need to be taken on a case-by-case basis. But the idea needs to be that sanctions, international isolation, these won't stop the war immediately, but these are long-term measures where over time, the Russian people start to wonder, why is the entire world banning us from these things? Why are we so alienated everywhere? Maybe this isn't just, and that isn't something that can happen overnight. The propaganda is effective. A lot of these ideas, especially about Ukrainian statehood or lack thereof, or its lack of legitimacy, these are deeply ingrained in Russian society. But with moves like this, you don't want to look like you're Russophobic, banning writers just because they're Russian, but you need to make clear to them that if you don't behave like a normal country, you don't get treated like a normal country. You get treated like Iran or Venezuela or North Korea. And that's the direction they're headed, and that's how they should be treated.
By the way, I had to have mixed feelings on this as well, too. I don't have anything against Wimbledon banning players, and I guess every organization needs to do what it feels like it needs to do. I would be much happier, though, if all of Europe were instead taking some measures that would actually make a difference in this war instead of, I mean, that's kind of a symbolic move in my mind. I think it sends a message. As Adam says, it might take longer. But, you know, I'd far rather see an announcement from the British government that it's re-engaging in fracking operations and drilling in the North Sea so that we can finally impose these energy sanctions we've been talking about and actually start stripping money away from Putin's military effort. Those are the things I prefer to be seeing happening in Europe rather than questions of tennis players.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Kim. The lack of energy sanctions on oil and gas sales by Russia is still an enormous loophole here that helps Putin finance the war. And of course, that's largely a position from Germany that continues to be a major problem. All right, let's turn to the French election, which is this weekend. Adam, on your visit to Paris, what have you found about the battle? Marine Le Pen lost in a rout 5 years ago to Macron. The polls shortly before the first round showed it very, very close in a potential runoff, but I gather the polls have widened since.
Yeah, it's amazing what actually campaigning will do for your campaign, I think is what Emmanuel Macron is figuring out. He had waited until the absolute last minute to announce that he was a candidate. I think everyone knew since the very beginning, since he won, that he would run for re-election. But he really stayed away from the campaign trail. He posed as a statesman. He's on the phone with Vladimir Putin, with Biden. And I think for a lot of French people, the French who have a great history and they are rightly proud of it and see themselves as a great power, it gave them a sense of security that their president was looking out for their interests and was playing a major role here. But I think his advisors were pretty spooked when some of those polls came in. He won, if I'm not mistaken, by 32 percentage points 5 years ago, and he's running against the same candidate. And now the average, there's an average of all the polls, sort of like what we have with Real Clear Politics that I was reading, and he's up by about 10 percentage points. But some showed that narrowing to 2, 3, or 4 points. And Macron is in a very bizarre situation as a candidate where he has managed to build what looks like, we'll find out, I mean, as you said when we were talking yesterday, populist surprise victories happen all the time. You know, they're unlikely, but they still happen. So maybe we'll be shocked. But I think what we'll be looking to see is whether Macron is able to sustain, even if it's not 66%, but if he can get 55, 56, 57%, that's a very solid win. But the paradox is he has almost no excited supporters. Granted, France is a huge country, and I spent time in Paris, which it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make for our readers to go to Paris in April.
I know.
Go out to a cafe and talk to political consultants.
Adam, this is what you do as a journalist. We're going to consign you for that quip. We're going to consign you to Brussels for several months on end, preferably in the cloudy winter months. Actually, come to think of it, Brussels is always cloudy.
Hey, I did a winter in Warsaw, okay? So I did my time. let's go to southern Spain or something. When I was speaking to voters, and it was a mixture of political consultants, right, different activists, people who had worked on some of the campaigns in the first round, and also just regular people. And I was talking to one guy who's an entrepreneur. He's not an entrepreneur, but he works for a startup, an early stage startup. And he said he voted for Macron. And I asked why, and he kind of just shrugged. And I think that pretty much summed up anyone I talked to who said they were voting for Macron, just completely shrugged. So he has this ability to win a clear majority, 55 plus, a very strong majority. But he's not beloved by anyone. He's not particularly well-liked even. He's respected, though. And it will be interesting to see what, if any, reform agenda he can get through. Historically, there haven't been a lot of incumbents. The French love to hate their president. It's something I really admire about the French, their disdain for people in power. But that also means that not a lot gets done when they don't have that political support and the streets come out and protest whatever they want to do.
The last second term, as I recall, in French recent history was Jacques Chirac, and that was a complete hopeless lost cause. Nothing much good happened at all, though he had come in the first term with a promise of reform. Kim, my sense is that the U.S. and much of Europe has a similar response as the French public to Macron, which is that, okay, you know, it's not thrilling, but he's certainly better than the alternative, who would be potentially catastrophic with Marine Le Pen's agenda being, I mean, she no longer wants to pull out of the EU, but she does want to pull out of NATO's command structure. And she's already said that she wants a new era of rapprochement between Europe and Russia. What that means in practical terms, who knows, but it almost certainly means forgiving Putin for his Ukrainian brutality.
Yeah, this is very much Europe and Macron's focus right now, because as Adam correctly pointed out, he's not much loved himself. And in fact, if you look at, for instance, the quite sizable block of voters in the first round who voted for the leftist candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, they outright dislike him because they feel as though, rather than being the centrist candidate that he campaigned on 5 years ago, that he's moved to the right. And so Macron's increasingly, his campaign has been about, instead of saying, come out and vote for me because you love me, he's saying, come out and vote just to make sure she doesn't get elected. And he's kind of hanging a lot on that. But I think to the extent that you have seen some movement in the polls and a little bit of widening, it is because people are looking at her actual record compared to the somewhat softened image that she's been presenting during this campaign. And the Ukrainian war is really highlighting this as well. I mean, if you look at her prior to the invasion, she had vowed an alliance with Russia, even if it ultimately meant U.S. sanctions on France. She had said that Ukraine belongs in Russia's sphere of influence. She's obviously met with Putin, and her campaign had accepted loans from Russian entities. And even now, she's continuing to say that she would pull France out of NATO's military command structure, which has led to a lot of really worrisome questions. Right now, for instance, France does surveillance flights in Poland. It's got troops in the Baltics. Would she actually move them? And I think that that's part of her problem, is that she has softened her tone, but she's got such a long record now of being much more honest about her ambitions to pull away from the EU, to pull away from NATO, to grow closer to Russia. And then you combine this with some of her economic policies, which some of them are a bit controversial as well. I think that that's maybe playing into why you see a slight change in the polls.
All right. We shall see what happens in France, obviously important for Europe and the United States. And not to mention the people of Ukraine. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Adam. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to write us if you have a question or a point to make at pwpodcast@wsj.com. We're here every day now on the Potomac Watch. So thanks for listening, and we hope to catch you tomorrow.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.